That's the trio Fingerpaint out of Portland, Oregon, with Anomabu. Ryan Cheng on sax, Adam Carpinelli on bass, and Chaz Mortimer is percussionist. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, July the 1st, and we present the sixth installment of a series that investigative reporter Paul DiRienzo has been presenting here on Lead Stories, about America's Fukushima, the largest ecological catastrophe in U.S. history. The series centers on the Hanford site, a sprawling nuclear reactor complex built on a 586-square-mile reservation on the Columbia River in south-central Washington state. Built in 1943, it was there that two-thirds of the nation's plutonium was manufactured for nuclear weapons during World War II and the Cold War. But the operation of its nine reactors phased out between 1968 and 1987 has created the largest ecological disaster in the United States, dumping a steady stream of industrial and radioactive waste directly into the air, the river, and the ground. Paul, glad to have you with us, and tell us what the focus is for today's edition, and sure. Of course, please do introduce our esteemed guest.
Great. Okay, I'd like to proud to introduce our guest. He's Tom Carpenter, who's the chairperson of Hanford Watch, which is an organization that has been for a number of years informing the public as to events, and he'll tell more about some of the specifics. But a lot of that has focused on the whistleblowers who stepped forward from the thousands of workers at Hanford, and the unending stream of whistleblowers who come forward over and over again to tell us about the problems there and the serious and dangerous working conditions. But even more recently, the workers who have been impacted by the chemical waste, who are actually involved in the cleanup work, and who have been, for lack of a better word, poisoned by the fumes and other things that are going on at Hanford in the course of their work. And also, I hope they'll tell us a little bit about some of the failures of the grandiose plans to clean up Hanford, which seem to be mired in controversy and even more dangers. And I don't know if it's ineptitude, or we'll find out more about that. So welcome, Tom, to Lead Stories.
Thanks, Paul. And I'm the executive director of Hanford Challenge.
Can I call it Watch? I'm sorry, I meant Challenge. Sorry.
That's okay. We do Watch Hanford, so it's apropos. It's fine.
Yes, yes. Very good. And Challenge Hanford as well. So let me begin with what's going on now, because it's my understanding that there are 38 workers in just the last few months who have come forward to say that their health has been severely impacted by fumes and leaks from the tanks they're working around at Hanford?
Well, it's 38 people who have been sent for medical evaluation with varying degrees of complaints following exposure to chemical vapors that come from these underground nuclear waste tanks. And some of those folks were hospitalized. somewhere off work for a couple of weeks. And, you know, the concern really is about their long-term health impacts, you know, whether or not this will lead to cancer or some other disease down the road.
So this is, it seems like the hamphocyte is the gift that keeps on giving, because the complaints of, you know, going back to the downwinders, does this give some credibility to the downwinders' claim that their health was injured over the last 40 years by, you know, folks who live in the, within 100 miles, let's say, or more of Hanford, who claim that they've been injured and have been involved in numerous lawsuits and other actions? Does this confirm what those folks have been saying all these years? Because I know many have said they've exaggerated, it couldn't have been, and et cetera, et cetera. So what do you think?
Well, it's a little bit apples and oranges, because the chemical vapors is a certain kind of injury due to chemical exposure. And some of the contaminants and chemicals we're talking about are known cancer-causing agents, it's mercury and attacks the brain. And the downwinders are largely concerned about radionuclides. There is an impact on Hanford workers and radionuclides that's been well established. So from that perspective, you're absolutely correct. The experience of the workforce has certainly been mirrored in the downwinder community in terms of excess cancer rates and whatnot, although studies so far, because of the burden of proof that science demands out there, you need a large study pool, et cetera. Still, you know, there were some tremendous doses that people received as a result of simply living nearby the Hanford Reservation and having a lot of radionuclides fall on their farms, onto the grass that their cows feasted from, and the milk became contaminated, et cetera. But that's another issue than the one we're talking about with the chemical vapors.
Okay, so that's interesting, because we've talked a lot about, being that there was 9 nuclear reactors working there and that nuclear weapons were produced there, much of the discussion often focuses on plutonium production, uranium, other radioactive, I mean, radiation, people are fearful of it and for good reason and focus on it. Yet what we're saying here is that there is a whole class of other pollutants equally, if not even more dangerous than the radioactive pollutants.
I wouldn't say they're more dangerous, because a lot of these chemicals may or may not last in the environment for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, and like the radionuclides. And the radionuclides are harder to treat, right? They're harder to, I mean, basically the only thing you can do with a radioactive product is to isolate it and let it decay away. In some cases, that will be in a few hundred years. In other cases, it might take hundreds of thousands of years or longer, depending on the kind of radionuclide. The chemicals can be treated. They can be captured more easily. They can be neutralized. Not to put too fine a distinction on it, but radioactive particles are chemicals, right? They just happen to be radioactive. So they actually act, they have molecular form, and some of these radionuclides, like cesium, act like potassium. Right, so that's why they hand out potassium iodide pills around nuclear plants, is to flood your system with potassium so you don't uptake cesium.
Right.
So the chemicals can act on the body in certain ways that are more destructive.
Right.
In some cases, depending on the kind of chemical you're talking about.
Well, the nuclear industry puts a lot of advertising. I've noticed a lot of things about how this is the clean energy alternative to coal and gas and the other things, which include fracking and give up. You seem to be saying that the only difference is whether you can detect easily the pollution or not between a coal plant and radio. Which is worse? Is the nuclear industry being telling us lies when they say that they have the clean alternative?
Well, of course. I mean, the nuclear industry has basically been built on a web of deception and lies from the very beginning. The very establishment of the commercial nuclear industry was to cover for our nuclear weapons program, because after the bombings in Japan, the first nuclear war, there was a lot of folks upset about what this means. Are we entering into a nuclear age where countries are going to be using nuclear weapons on each other. And, you know, so far that hasn't happened, but, you know, there's a great concern about that out there. And they needed a peaceful face for the nuclear weapons technology and the buildup, the massive buildup of nuclear weapons. Hanford did create the plutonium to fuel tens of thousands of these weapons, as many as 65,000 nuclear weapons. And the leftover waste product is what we're dealing with at the Hanford site now. But the whole nuclear power thing is a different thing than what we're talking about at Hanford these days. We're really talking about
There is one power reactor there operating on the Hanford Reservation.
Well, there sure is, the Columbia Generating Station, and it has the distinction of being, I think, the third worst safety record in the industry. It's a Fukushima-style reactor, a boiling water reactor, GE design Mark II, and Fukushima was Mark I, but it has some of the same design issues and flaws. But again, that's not actually even considered part of Hanford. It's on the Hanford Reservation, but it's owned by a public utility and a consortium of utilities in Washington State.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, this is your Trace lead. How are you? And I'm glad to hear that you're on the program today, of course. I wanted to ask, because you're dealing with people who are on the inside of this industry, and you've been privy to, I would say, confidential information that they have shared with you as whistleblowers. What would you say are the top revelations that people need to know about not just the Hanford site, but specifically, since we're talking about it, but related the industry itself? So let's talk first. What are the top revelations about the Hanford site that should concern citizens?
Well, I think the top revelation would be that despite assurances, the many, many assurances to the contrary, that Hanford is safe, it's not. There are a lot of very, very high risk issues at Hanford that require a lot of management and a lot of luck. And Hanford has had some very close calls. So far, it has, you know, it's had its share of accidents and problems, but none that were catastrophic in nature, you know, that caused immediate contamination of an area so vast that you had to evacuate that resource. But I think that's a very possible thing to happen. And so what people are telling us on the inside is that the nuclear safety rules are being relaxed so that corporations can maximize their profits, and that, you know, as the site goes on, the government becomes more anxious just to close it down, and there's a lot of concern about whether or not, for instance, you know, the waste treatment plant, which is being constructed to deal with the tank waste at the Hanford site, is in itself a safety menace. That if you run that facility, that it may not, you know, it may not be safe to be around. They're risking hydrogen gas explosions and unplanned nuclear criticalities, which is a heck of a thing for a site that's supposed to be there for cleaning up the waste. So then we also hear about a lot of unresolved safety concerns at Hanford that just don't seem to occur to the Hanford folks, that this is something that needs to be dealt with. And, you know, it's kind of a constant barrage of information about things where Hanford just doesn't have a handle on it. So it's quite concerning, really, that every day is Russian roulette at Hanford, as far as I'm concerned. And we are spending a good deal of money at the Hanford site to clean it up, but a good deal of that money is also simply to manage risks. And my concern is that Congress, you know, doesn't recognize that the agency that's in charge of this is really not equipped to deal with managing these risks or with managing this cleanup, and that they'll get tired of paying for it, and then we'll have a a disaster that reminds us that this stuff is so dangerous that you really can't play games with it. You really do have to spend the money and get the talent in there to make sure that you're protecting the public.
Now, to your knowledge, I just want to follow up. To your knowledge, or to the information that you've had so far coming to you via whistleblowers, has America really experienced a nuclear accident without anybody knowing it?
No, that would be quite difficult. And, you know, Hanford is the closest you can come to that because, I mean, obviously we had Three Mile Island and that released a certain amount of radiation. But and that was more like a close call because, you know, a reactor core melted in that accident. It wasn't supposed to happen. So that was a wake-up call. Like, the amount of radiation that actually was released from that is unknown, but not, you know, considered to be. I mean, there's no residual effects out there that I know of in terms of radiation in the environment that makes living around that environment untenable, like at Fukushima and like at Chernobyl. That's certainly the case, though, around the Hanford site. Hanford is, for all purposes and effects, a national sacrifice zone. There's a large area of land around the Hanford site that encompasses the Hanford site that will essentially never be inhabitable for humans for centuries to come and maybe longer, depending on the level of cleanup that's conducted out there. Just one example is, let's set aside the nuclear waste tanks, the 177 tanks, and the 56 million gallons of waste there. They've got 45 miles of trenches of hazardous waste. If you laid out these trenches end to end, they would stretch about 42 to 45 miles, and each trench is 20 feet deep and 15 feet long and contains a horrendous mixture of radionuclides and chemicals and vials and boxes, simply sometimes just dumped into there in liquid form. And, you know, the planet Hanford is largely simply to leave that stuff there. It's, you know, deemed too expensive and too troublesome to even characterize what's in these trenches. It's just, you know, so the government is kind of in a pitched battle with tribes and citizens groups in the area to say, no, you will look at that. But it's almost a sideshow because the tanks are so dangerous. And the waste in those tanks is so bad, and they've already leaked 1 million gallons, at least, from these tanks. Some people say 6 million gallons. We don't really know, and they don't really know.
Right.
It's all guesswork. But where's that waste going to go? You know, presuming you even clean up the waste tanks. So I think we're in a crisis, an environmental crisis, at the Hanford site that people don't even know about. People have, even here in Washington State, people that have heard of Hanford thinks, you know, it's been cleaned up or it's in the process of being cleaned up, and not realizing that actually there are a lot of issues and problems that have yet to be addressed out there and that there is an ongoing crisis.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very interesting because we touched earlier in that question on the possibility could a disaster have happened at Hanford that we don't know about that was kept secret. And, for example, there are many incidents that have come forward that we have learned about. There were actually intentional releases for experimental purposes of radiation. There was a lot going on with the health radiation department at Hanford that involved men with white suits going out into the countryside and collecting urine samples from people and things like that. The original choice of Hanford was it was chosen because it was in between two low ranges of hills and mountains to contain a disaster in case it did happen. Could there be secrets going on that we haven't discovered yet, the things that happened between 1943 and 1987 that are still secret that we just don't know about?
Oh, sure. You know, but I think the evidence of a massive release would be evidence, right? I mean, that's something... I go out with scientists periodically. We test the environment. We take samples from the river, from the countryside, and people's houses. And no doubt, you know, on occasion we find, you know, localized hot spots and hot radioactive trees and fish that have radiation in them, et cetera, that doesn't, you know, clearly they're problems, but not on a massive scale. And I've seen massive scale because I've been to Russia, you know, 6 times and visited some of their sites that, wow, right? You know, it's like, you know, 40 miles away that there's a problem.
Right.
You just spin down and pick up, you know, something and put your Geiger counter next to it, and it starts getting tickled.
Right.
And then the closer you get, you just find these tremendous levels of radioactivity. And when you analyze the spectrum of radioisotope, it's off the charts. It's, you know, this is, these are radionuclides that have no business being in the environment, like phosphorus 32 with a 14-day half-life, fiercely radioactive. That's in Russia. Nothing like that is happening at Hanford. The nature of the crisis is different, and that is that you've got a lot of stuff stored on site in failed and leaking underground waste tanks. It's two-thirds of the nation's inventory of high-level nuclear waste. It's got chemicals in it as well as the radionuclides that are dangerous, and they help transport this waste through the soils because they're degreasers, right? They were there to immobilize the waste in the first place. And, you know, really what's at risk is, an explosion or fire in these tanks, either because of an earthquake or because of a chemical reaction or because of carelessness, and, B, migration of this stuff down into the groundwater, which is happening, and that goes to the river, the Columbia River. And these are the long-lived radionuclides that if enough gets into that river, you will lose that resource. And the Columbia River is the second most powerful river in the United States. Over 1 million people depend on that river for livelihood, you know, for clean water, for, you know, resources like fish, for recreation. You know, you can't lose a resource like that. And yet that's what's at risk if we don't get this place cleaned up.
Now, the cleanup is being headed by the Bechtel Corporation and its subcontractors, and they are basically working for the Department of Energy, which is the an agency of the federal government. Who is responsible? Is the DOE ultimately responsible? Can Bechtel just hand it over and say, listen, we're just working for the government, it's their problem?
Oh, sure. And there's actually several contractors out there responsible for several areas of the cleanup. So Bechtel's responsible for this waste treatment plant that's supposed to mix high-level nuclear waste with molten glass, and then that glass will be allowed to cool in these tanks, and the tanks will be buried underground somewhere in the future someday, maybe. So that's one project. It's the biggest project out there. But then you've got the tank farms, and that's being run by another contractor called URS. And URS has several other contracts at the Hanford site. So those are the two big contractors, along with finally another one called CH2M Hill. The Department of Energy hires each of these companies to run various aspects of this cleanup. You know, Hanford employs some 9,000 to 10,000 workers, maybe 2,000 of them have direct frontline contact with the waste. That, you know, they're actually out there with shovels in the ground and pumping waste or taking care of protecting people from radiation or whatever. So, and the rest are planners and engineers and bureaucrats and whatnot. So that's kind of the
right.
But yeah, in the end, the government owns this site and is responsible for it, and they hire and fire contractors as needed.
Now, what is the government's response to these numerous whistleblowers who stepped forward? Donna Bushy, who was employed by URS, Walter Tamositis, also URS, Don Alexander, David Bruce, and these are names, a list of names I have, David Blake. I just go page after page of names of people who come forward to say there's problems at Hanford. What is the message that these whistleblowers have come forward with, and what has been the reaction of the government, which is ultimately responsible, when whistleblowers who are employed by subcontractors and contractors come forward and say there's problems?
Well, yeah, and it's not just at contractors. There are Department of Energy whistleblowers as well. And, you know, I don't believe that the DOE believes that there are any whistleblowers at the Hanford site. you know, they have this, you know, policy that they call the zero tolerance for reprisal policy. And it's like, we will not tolerate anyone being discriminated against for raising a safety concern at Hanford. It's like, really? Show me an example of where you wouldn't tolerate that. You know, show me an example of where you even acknowledged that someone was retaliated against. To them, it's all just personnel issues. And they never, even when we get court decisions where people have won their cases and a jury has said these people were all retaliated against, the Department of Energy has been silent. It has done nothing. It has held no one accountable, and they have no plans ever to do so, as far as I can, you know, and concerned. So they live in a mythological world of magical thinking where you can say it and it becomes so, but they don't have to back it up with any behaviors. And in fact, their behaviors are, you know, absolutely contrary to, you know, what they say. So an example is, safety is their first priority, right? That's what they say. There's billboards, there's bumper stickers, there's, you know, inserts in the paychecks. They have safety meetings, safety, 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 and you really get sick and tired of hearing it. Yet, 38 people are sent to the hospital or for medical evaluation because of exposure to unknown chemicals, made sick, so sick that they can't work for a while. And there's a whole bunch of people who are sick, so sick that they will never work again, and some have died. And yet, the contractor gets us an outstanding safety rating just last week for their great health and safety program. That comes with, you know, additional fee. It comes with more self-regulation. It comes with, you know, parties and flags and kudos and big celebrations on the site. What about those 38 people that just got exposed since March 19th alone? And they can't say what is going to happen to the fate of these people if they're going to, you know, suffer cancer or something down the road, like some of the other workers that have been exposed in the past. So it's a system that says one thing and does another. And it's true for the whistleblowers as well. They've had a zero tolerance policy since 1988. They've articulated this policy. And it's failed utterly to do anything to protect a single whistleblower. They've never reinstated someone. You know, they've never thanked someone or protected them in any way unless they're ordered to do so by a court. And even then, they grumble about it, and those people usually don't last out there. So it's a real issue at this site that, and just last week, another DOE report came out saying 70% of employees are not comfortable in challenging a management decision at the Hanford Waste Treatment Plant. That's within the Department of Energy. You know, at Bechtel, it's another 50%. I mean, these are astounding numbers. You shouldn't have a single person afraid to raise a safety concern. But when you have half the workforce or more worried about what might happen to them if they say something, then you are guaranteed to have unreported safety issues and problems that may come down the road later, and that valve fails, that pump fails, you know, something wasn't installed right, it was preventable. But people were too afraid to talk about it. That is a system that DOE has carefully and deliberately built, and the contractors have carefully and deliberately built over the years. They've punished anyone who told the truth, and all the way up to the highest levels, like Donna Bushy. And well, yeah, she was the manager of nuclear safety out there, right? And she, it was her job as one of the top professionals in the country on nuclear safety to make sure that the design and construction of that, of the waste treatment plant conformed to the nuclear safety requirements, that the design was safe, that in case of a problem out there, an earthquake, a fire, or something like that, that the design was robust enough to protect the public from these radionuclides. She testified in open hearings that that was not the case, that there were, you know, problems with the mixing of this waste that could cause hydrogen gas buildup, that in case of an accident, the radionuclides would not simply drop to the ground, but would keep on going into the communities, arguing for, you know, greater safety oversight. And instead, you know, the response to her was to isolate her, to harass her, to take away her resources, to accuse her of harassing mm-hmm. emails. Well, the harassing yeah. email that I saw that she was accused of sending was exhorting her team to do better, right? And that we're gonna outperform what the customer expects. That mm-hmm. was it. I mean, it was like, what? No, this is your normal boss email to your troops saying, let's go. This is what they could come up with, accuse her of being, this is the justification they used to fire her in February. The manager of nuclear safety, a key person and one of the top professionals in the country. And it's not the first. There have been a whole string of these people who have been fired. And again, the Department of Energy sits there and does not a thing. That's called condoning it through their silence.
I wanted to ask you about Dr. Tamasitis in particular. He filed a lawsuit in Washington State Court, and he was removed. And it was interesting what they did to him. I mean, the whole litany of retaliations against him would fill a book, putting him in a small office. Maybe you could tell us about what was done, what he said, what he exposed, and then what was done to him over a number of years by his employers.
Well, it's apropos that we're talking about it because it's now 4 years to the day when he was removed, right? Okay. So it was coming up on July 4th weekend in 2010 when Dr. Tamasitis, a PhD, several degrees, a chemical engineer, he was the manager of research and technology, and it was his job to find and resolve technical problems associated with the waste treatment plant, which was under design and construction at the time. And Bechtel was under tremendous pressure to complete the design, call it good, and pivot, the word they used, to finishing the construction and commissioning of the plant. So no more design issues. We've resolved all that. And that was a July 1st, I think, deadline. And Walt wrote a memo saying we're not there, essentially, that there are some questions pending about mixing and of the waste and how that could generate, insufficient mixing could generate hydrogen gas build up that could catch on fire, explode, and cause a major release into the environment.
Just for a second, because I just want to start to interrupt, but you mentioned hydrogen gas many times in this discussion. So folks know hydrogen gas buildup is what caused the disaster at Three Mile Island.
Well, in Fukushima as well.
At Fukushima, when the gas is created by the natural reaction of these elements in a closed space, an explosive gas is produced that could explode, blow up, and then, cause all kinds of problems, as we've seen.
Right. They had several hydrogen gas explosions in the spent fuel pools and the reactor buildings at Fukushima. Mm-hmm. We saw that on TV. It was a horrific thing to see, and it's one of the biggest things you have to worry about when it comes to releases of radionuclides and chemicals at a nuclear facility. Mm-hmm. And he reported that and said, you're not ready to go. Internal emails that were obtained after he was fired showed that the president or the general manager of the company ordering URS to get Walt off the project by the end of the day, that he had pissed off a bunch of people. The manager of the DOE at the site, for them, was also urging that they get rid of Walt. He was mad as hell that Walt had written this. Walt was doing his job. It was his job to find these problems and report them honestly. And he didn't do anything wrong. They have nothing to show that he might have done something wrong, and they never said what he had done, right? He was just simply fired. Right? You're off the project. And he was taken downtown. He still worked for URS, but he was given a basement office with a copy machine, two copy machines, no one else there. It was, where the janitor stored brooms and, there are boxes of paper down there. And he was ignored. He was given no
job. A novel. It's like something out of a novel. It's hard to believe that it really happened.
He told me a story that, his wife called him and said, what are you doing there? He goes, what are you talking about? She goes, it's snowing like crazy outside. They canceled work. Everyone's gone home. And Walt said, really? And he went upstairs, and the whole building was dark, and it was locked in. And, I mean, this is – no one cared about it. He was the living example of what happens to a successful senior manager, a Ph.D., a respected scientist who said – you know, got in the way of these big corporations that wanted to make a bunch of money. And then sure enough, man, they got, $6 million, to say that they had resolved the design issues. And then they turned around and got another $50 million out of Congress.
Right.
That they were so pleased with, well, it didn't work, because now the design issues are still outstanding, right? Yet what happened to Bechtel? They've gotten more money than ever, right? They're sitting in a spot to make, four times, five times what they originally projected the plant to cost. All their mistakes, they're profiting from, they're benefiting from. The Department of Energy, has said, we want to work with these guys closer. We want to collaborate with them. And it's like, really? No, you need to fire them. They've hosed you. They've done nothing but ignore the nuclear safety regulations. They fired their own employees who raised the problems, not just Walt, not just Donna, but other people as well. And they continue, from my perspective, to mismanage the site, right? And yet they get away with it. And it's just like, what is going on? This is like the giant ATM in the desert for corporations to come and put their little card in and withdraw billions of dollars of taxpayer money unaccountably. And yet we don't get the cleanup we need out of it.
Well, the picture you have painted so far, Tom, is pretty scary. You have an industry that is dealing in a really crazily, a very dangerous product, if you will, which is radiation. There is no way to destroy it. Once it's created, and it is going to have a lifespan of some thousands or maybe even more years. You're talking about an industry that is not being properly regulated. You're talking about an industry, in fact, in which people are being punished for sounding the alarm about a number of things that are going wrong and that potentially can go wrong. To me, as a consumer, a regular person, listening to what you're saying and putting pieces together, this is, in fact, our own weapons of mass destruction that Americans are living with, the nuclear industry. Why isn't it viewed that way within the within Congress and other places, where we can see that there's a need for them to be very vigilant, because in fact a malfunctioning nuclear plant is itself a weapon of mass destruction?
Well, they don't see it that way because Congress is ruled by special interests. Bechtel and others have very powerful lobbyists. The Department of Energy itself is very busy lobbying Congress to get what they want. They've got a constant presence on the Hill, in Capitol Hill, visiting all the key congressional offices. Money flows into their campaigns from all of these companies, which is legal. Right? That's their First Amendment right to do that. And, nobody else has the ability to match that. And so Congress looks the other way. Congress has not held a hearing on Hanford for quite a while.
Wasn't there a Senate hearing a few weeks ago, a couple months ago?
Yeah, there's one in March with McCaskill. But it really, yes, it was about Hanford, and kind of it was. It was more about whistleblowers, and it was great that she did that. But the whistleblowers weren't even allowed to testify in the hearing. I mean, so that's kind of ludicrous, right? It says it all, that the only people that actually officially testified at that hearing were Department of Energy and contractor presidents to sit up there and say they couldn't remember anything. So that was the gist of the hearing. Otherwise, there was like this little, press thing beforehand where, Walt and Donna were allowed to speak. And testimony was put into the record, but, the optics of it were really quite interesting, where the whistleblowers were silenced from being able to testify formally in the hearing. I don't even count that practically as a hearing. And Congress is doing nothing about this stuff, and they write occasional letters, right? They do say the right things on occasion, and a lot of times, though, they don't, right? No, they're not pro-safety. They don't take the actions necessary. They're simply trying to protect the corporations and the government. As far as I can tell, we don't have an audience. I mean, our own senator, Senator Murray, Patty Murray here, she's a very progressive senator on many counts, but when it comes to Hanford, her staff is hostile to me. It's like they look at me as the enemy walking in. I get the rudest receptions you can imagine, even much ruder than some of the Republicans that I go and visit with who don't agree with me overtly. And, you know, they're good buddies with the contractors. And they're good buddies with DOE, and they don't do oversight. They just deliver money to the site. That's how they define their role. Mm-hmm. And you know, they need to wake up and realize that if they're not watching out for safety, nobody's watching out for safety, right? Mm-hmm. It's really up to Congress and the administration to assure that the appropriate steps are taken to protect us from these radionuclides, and that's not happening.
I see. Now, there's two things that have happened in the last few months that alarmed me, and they almost, you know, seemed like something out of the X-Files, but they really did happen. Number one, a dam 20 miles upriver from Hanford developed out of nowhere, a 65-foot crack, and then it was discovered that back in 1960, the dam had been improperly constructed. And now the lake behind the dam had to be lowered 150 feet, and there was a possibility for a time of a catastrophic failure of that dam. Almost at the exact same time, a fire, an explosion, occurs at the waste isolation pilot program in Carlsbad, New Mexico, where eventually the waste from the plant we're discussing in Hanford is supposed to be stored if they could ever get the plant working. And now there's plutonium dust in the air throughout New Mexico, which is, of course, the slightest little bit of plutonium is potentially a cancer causer. So what's happening now? I mean, are we at the verge of this Fukushima-style natural disaster, or are these things just coincidences?
No, it's a buildup of lack of safety culture. You know, they don't have any they define, you know, these incidents as incredible, like it'll never happen. Therefore, they don't guard against it. You know, because of that dismissive attitude that refuses to recognize reality, that's how I look at it, then you can't have a Three Mile Island, right? It's just not possible. That's one in a million chance, and yet it happened. And the waste isolation pilot project that you mentioned, the site in New Mexico, you know, that was never supposed to happen, ever. Like, they designed this facility to never leak, much less above ground, right? It was going to be contained. It was going to be safe. They didn't have to worry about it. So they had no contingency plans. You know, I was like, wow, that's really dumb. Right. You know, the NRC has known for decades that, you know, dam failures are one of the biggest risks when it comes to nuclear facilities. But they refuse to guard against it. You know, the Union of Concerned Scientists just wrote a book about Fukushima, pointing out that a lot of NRC staff has been worried about dam failures for quite a while, but they don't really have contingency plans for it. While it's the kind of accident that could ruin the electrical systems, you know, knock out the power of, you know, these facilities for you know, days or weeks, and it only takes hours for meltdowns to occur and for hydrogen gas to build up. And you know, once it builds up, past 3% of the atmosphere, you can pretty much guarantee it will explode. It takes very, very little energy to ignite hydrogen gas.
All right. If anybody is familiar with the Hindenburg explosion in New Jersey 80 years ago, you know, you could see how devastating hydrogen gas explosions can be. What about earthquakes? I know we've mentioned there's an increased possibility of earthquakes now in the Hanford area, much more than was originally.
It's not an increased possibility of earthquakes. It's a growing recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, wow, they're starting to map out. Well, Fukushima was very interesting because, you know, the after effects of that massive, massive earthquake in Japan were felt, of course, around the world. And so scientists that were monitoring, you know, ground motion activity and earthquake faults, et cetera, learned a lot from that here in Washington State and in California. And, you know, they learned from new data that there were more faults that went further, that were more dangerous at the Hanford site, affecting the Columbia Generating Station, which was designed to take so much. Well, it's now beyond, the earthquake potential is beyond the design capacity. And certainly at Hanford, which, you know, most of the facilities at Hanford were built to withstand, you know, at most a 5.0 on the Richter scale earthquake, and they're now postulating it could be worse. Well, these were facilities built 40 and 50 years ago, you know, and they're built to withstand a certain kind of motion, you know, a swaying motion as opposed to an up and down motion, et cetera. So these kind of, depending on the motion activity, can put stresses on these buildings that they're just not designed to take. Right. So that's the real concern.
There's so much, but in the last, you know, earlier in this discussion, we talked about nuclear power and its relation to nuclear weapons and that they were distinguished and separate from each other. Yet at the same time, there was an interrelationship. For example, it's my understanding the N reactor, the last and largest reactor at Hanford, produced actually relatively little plutonium. Most of the time, it produced electricity that was used to subsidize the production of the plutonium. That, in fact, the production of electricity and of power was tied directly into the whole process of making nuclear weapons, a way to pay for it. Our nuclear power, it's coming back, it's resurging in America. Do we, you know, should fear this? Is this something that is a warning from Hanford about what happens if we turn to this new technology?
Well, you know, I think there's an attempt to cause a resurgence. You know, it's not much to point at right now. You've got a couple of reactors under construction in Georgia. You know, I'm not sure what else is viable out there. Mm-hmm. The fact is that these power plants are tremendously expensive. They're tremendously risky. Wall Street does not want to back them. The only way these plants get built is with 100% loan guarantee subsidies from the U.S. government, our taxpayer money. Now, what other industry gets 100% loan guarantees, right? Is that true for solar? Is it true for wind? Of course not, right? And even more than that, the U.S. taxpayer, the U.S. government, limits the liability on these accidents, absolves the utilities that run these plants for liability except for a certain amount of money, which they have to pay for in case of a nuclear accident. And the government will limit to 3 cents on the dollar all the damage that could result, which, you know, you could lose cities and very large regions, right? Look at what Fukushima is costing the Japanese, right? We're into the hundreds of billions of dollars so far. And, you know, it may cost $500 billion to clean it up. It may cost more. We don't know.
And did you have the WHOOPS organization, the nuclear power plant at the Washington Public Power Service, which was called WHOOPS because it was the largest default in American history?
Yeah, it was a $20 billion bond default,
That people are still paying for in their electric bills to this day.
Yes.
And that plant.
Yeah, so Governor Dixie Lee Ray was a Washington governor who used to be also the chair of the Atomic Energy Commission. When she became governor, she, you know, embarked on this very stupid and ambitious program to put in dozens of nuclear reactors in the state of Washington all at once. And it just turned out that one plant survived that, right, debacle, and that was the Columbia Generating Station, which is now, you know, at the end of its design life, and yet the NRC has extended it for another 40 years in advance, and without much public comment, you know, and ignoring all the big issues like earthquakes and all that. They just kind of went, you know, bullying ahead on it. Well, that's, you know, the NRC is an agency that is very promotional of nuclear power, and we need to be worried about that as a society because we need a regulator. As long as we're going to have this, and I don't agree personally with having it, I think it's too risky. You know, I think that there's too much that can go wrong, and the consequences are just too great. Like, how many thousands of square miles can we afford to lose as humanity? How many, you know, how much pollution of the gene pool can we afford? And we don't have any solution for this nuclear waste. Those are three strikes, you're out.
I just want to get a sense, because we are coming to the close of the program. I just wanted to know from you, Tom Carpenter, what would you what is the main occupation you have now at Hanford Challenge, and what should people be aware of?
So, you know, our mission is to see that Hanford is cleaned up effectively and in a protective manner, protective of human health and of the environment. That means we're in it for the long haul. We work with whistleblowers primarily, insiders who need protection when they step forward with their concerns. We participate in the advisory boards. We do reports. We do, you know, Freedom of Information Act reports, requests, and we find out what's going on. And, you know, we're the primary disclosers of, you know, bad problems out there, because the government doesn't tell you anything about that's bad. If you go to their website, it's all, you know, butterflies and wonderful things. But, you know, there's no source of information about what's really happening at Hanford except the whistleblowers and groups like ours. You know, and the communities out there are pretty much, you know, promoters of the plant. They don't like to hear bad things either.
And programs like this, I should add.
What's that?
Programs like this, I should add.
Oh, absolutely. The news media is crucial. Without the news media, you know, it'd be almost impossible for us to do our job. But, you know, usually when there's big exposés, Congress reacts to it because they feel like they need to. But it's almost like the bar has been raised. Now it's like, oh, you got to kill some people, right? There needs to be a disaster before Congress will act. And maybe not even then. Who knows? But it's kind of frustrating, this point. You know, I've been involved in this for over 25, you know, years at Hanford, and you know, it's at a very low point right now where it just seems like there's no accountability, no transparency, and no cleanup.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. And Paul, close out, would you please?
Yes. Just, thank you, Tom Carpenter, for joining us and giving us a view, an overall view, overarching view of exactly what the problems we face at Hanford are. And it describes to me sort of a slow motion of Fukushima, but one operating in slow motion that could speed up at any time if the wrong ingredient is added to the mix, whether a dam failure or an underground explosion or an earthquake or what have you. So in a lot of ways, whatever the government says, we seem to be on the precipice. And so I want to be filled with hope at the end of a conversation like this, but I think what we're really looking into is an abyss, and I think it's important to get this word out. So thank you very much, Tom, for joining us, and we're going to do our best to get the word out to America about what in the world what they face.
We'll turn it around. It just is going to take patience and persistence and direct communication. So thank you for your role in that.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So much.
Okay.
And thanks again, Paul, for being with me today and for bringing this edition to us on the Hanford site. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let us hear from you. What are you thinking about these programs and how they resonate with you? You could write me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Utrecht Lead on Facebook. And Paul also gets messages from – did he leave already? Okay, Paul. Well, Paul is also on Facebook, Paul DiRienzo, DiRienzo, is also reachable there on Facebook. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to keep it right here. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hope this was useful to you and expanded your information about America's largest ecological catastrophe.